they tried to find it with languages. They looked at different languages that people speak and say, can we find genetic differences based on languages? They could find nothing. In terms of the way we govern ourselves, they could find nothing. The economy, they could find nothing. But the thing that they did not comment on is how human culture explodes upon the scene. It doesn't evolve. It comes upon the scene immediately and at a very highly advanced level, and we don't see evolution. Hence, probably the best documentation of that would be what they call the Big Bang of art, where art just explodes upon the scene at the very beginnings of human existence. And what we see 33,000 years ago is art that's as advanced as art today. I mean, it's not kind of a crippled art. It's as expressive, as detailed, as full of what they don't address, spirit, as art that we see today. And that date, it's roughly 40,000 years ago, we see all these big bangs taking place in terms of the human species. It's the first time you see the use of clothing. But by the way, they had zero evidence that any of the bipedal primates that preceded us used clothing. Clothing shows up for the first time with human beings. And then what's particularly dramatic is what they call a big bang of jewelry. And, you know, jewelry shows up upon the scene in more abundance than tools. I mean, the expectation of the physical anthropologist... You're laughing. I mean, you see this crude tool use amongst the bipedal primates, basically rocks that are just flakes that they pick up and they use for various purposes. And human beings show up upon the scene, and you see this explosion in tool technology, where you see tools that are designed to make tools. It's the first time you see that is with human beings, and where you see actually, you know, wood handles attached by thongs to pieces of rock that are shaped and used for you know, complex purpose. Where you see fish hooks showing up for the first time. But what surprised all the anthropologists is they expected that there would be this abundance of tools, but what they find is that the jewelry is even more abundant than the tools, and it shows up right away. And of course, there's no jewelry with the bipedal primates. It's only the human species that has all this body jewelry. And they were thinking, well, maybe it's just tools that were co-opted for jewelry, but they discovered that wasn't true, that the jewelry that they find has no tool value whatsoever. And so all this jewelry just shows up all of a sudden. So that too. I mean, music shows up explosively. But my whole point here is that given there isn't a genetic connection with the diversity, and that's the other thing that they don't point out, is that human cultural diversity also explodes upon the scene. Is that you have this very advanced culture, but it doesn't just come across as advanced culture that splits into all these different pieces. We see that the diversity is right there. So as far back as we can dig in terms of the archaeology, we see this multiplicity of languages and of a culture and different economies and way of governing one another without genetic link. And again, it comes explosively upon the scene. Now, from biblical perspective, I'd argue this is all very understandable. Genesis 11 tells us that God came down and forced cultural diversity upon us. He forced language diversity upon us. According to this study, he didn't do it by changing our genes. He did it by changing something else within us. And that's really the thing that's missing in this article in Nature, not one acknowledgement that unlike the other animals, we are spirit creatures. I mean, that's really what they're missing. They didn't quite figure out that we were created in the image of God. And, you know, God can put into us diversity, not by messing with our genes, but by imposing things at the spirit level. So that's what's missing in the article. But what I found encouraging is just throughout the whole article was this expression of utter astonishment. This is in here. We don't know how to explain it. The genetic connection doesn't work. We don't know what's going on. But again, they're trying to look at it from a naturalistic perspective. Yes. Do I know how the different races came about? Well, not really. I've speculated on this in my book, The Genesis Question. There's a chapter there in The Origin of the Races. What I try to point out in that chapter is that trying to explain human racial diversity based on Darwinian principles or any other naturalistic model really doesn't fly, because you've got very little time. you're talking 40, 50,000 years to make it happen. And, you know, the naturalistic model would have to say there's something within the environment that would cause natural selection to bring about these different racial differences. But we're different from the animals. I mean, you can look at sheep, for example. There are black sheep and there are white sheep. But what you don't see is all the black sheep congregating on one continent and the white sheep congregating on another. They seem to be fairly mixed. I mean, as you go through a region, you'll see some black sheep and some white sheep. Likewise with the goats, you'll see these different colors. But what's unique about human beings, at least until modern times, is that the racial differences remain geographically separated. And they also was a language connection. You know, you wouldn't expect that. Why would certain races stick to just one set of languages and not the other? But we see that as well. Now, in the context of Genesis 11, I would argue that makes sense, although Genesis 11 does not say a word about racial diversity. The only thing you see within Scripture is this. The book of Genesis is silent on racial diversity. But by the time you get to the opening chapters of Exodus, it's talking about racial diversity. Earliest references to it is when Moses is criticized by his fellow Jews for having a dark-skinned wife. So evidently, most Jews were light-skinned, but he had a dark-skinned wife, and he was criticized for it. So, and then one of the real problems is that the naturalists say, well, you know, if you have light skin, you're able to process more vitamin D from sunlight. And therefore, you would, you know, if you live in the northern latitudes where the sunlight isn't very strong, then having that extra vitamin D conversion capability would give you advantage over having a dark skin. Therefore, they say white skin in the north. And likewise, they'll make the point, well, I mean, if you're dark skin, you have to spend a little more energy to build the melanin to make that skin. There's a food budget difference. But the problem with those kinds of arguments is that the differences are really slight. Dark-skinned people have vitamin D production capability as well. It's not quite as efficient as with a white skin, but the difference is really trivial. And likewise, I'd argue that people with white skin tend to have to eat as many hamburgers as people with dark skin. There really isn't a food advantage that's hardly, I mean, you really can't measure it. And therefore, what is it within the environment that could possibly drive these differences? And the real killer is the fact that, guess what color the Eskimos are? They're not light-skinned. So it would break the rule from a naturalistic perspective. But it wouldn't break the rule in the context of Genesis chapter 11, which I, well, we taught on that in this class. That, you know, my perspective on it is that this is God establishing a free market competition principle, which I would argue is in the entire Bible. I mean, you see it in the book of Acts. You see it everywhere that, you know, Christianity has a huge advantage over competing faiths and that it can survive in a free market environment. I mean, if you go to Saudi Arabia, for example, they have a law. You must be a Muslim. And if you convert from Islam to anything else, there will be very severe penalties. It's not exactly a free market. And, you know, people are not given the freedom to proselytize Muslims to the faith. You see the same thing in India. They have laws there, too, that are designed to prevent a free market competitive environment over which religion you'd like to adopt. And I believe that's the reason why Scripture teaches this free market principle. And I would believe, I think you can find places, you'd probably be the best guy to argue on this. There are passages in the Bible that talk about economic free market principles, idea free market principles, religious free market principles, and in the case of Genesis 11, I believe it's teaching that God wanted to set up a system of nations where nations would be competing with one another for citizens in a free market situation. And you know, what I argue when I taught on this, what you see in Genesis 11, is God establishes geographical boundaries for the nations, he gives different languages to the nations. It's possible he also gave them different ethnicity. And I would say racial diversity may be maybe not a totally inappropriate term. I mean, we identify, what, four major races amongst human beings, but there are many more ethnic groups than there are races. And the genetic differences between the races are really quite trivial, so maybe we need to use a different term. But the whole point is God has given each nation an ethnic people, a language, and geographical boundaries. Now, what's interesting in each case is the geographical boundaries have been designed ahead of time by God to be high enough to prevent one supernation dominating all the nations of the world, but low enough that if one nation oppresses its citizens, they can leave and go to the next nation. And likewise, the language barrier is not so high as to prevent, you know, people in one nation leaving that nation and adopting another language. I mean, people do that here in America. They come from countries with other languages. So the languages are close enough together that the people can switch. And likewise, the ethnic barriers are low enough that people can switch. But they're also high enough to prevent this domination of one nation overall. That is until the 20th century. What's happened in the 20th century is we've become so affluent, we've become so technologically capable, so transport capable, that these barriers are basically meaningless. And so we're seeing all over the world, our language is disappearing. Boundaries really are not adequate for a nation to protect itself against stronger nations. And likewise, racial diversity or ethnicity is no longer a barrier. Los Angeles, I think, is a perfect example of that. Not that many people marry, spouses of their own ethnic background. Kathy claims that I'm of a completely different ethnic background than she is. And our boys testify to that. So I think you know what I mean. But the whole point is, God did this from his perspective. And according to this article, it looks like he didn't do it primarily through the genes, if maybe not through the genes at all. He was working through the fact that unlike other species of life, we are body, soul, and spirit. And so God can impose things at the spiritual level that with other species, you're only going to find at the physical level. So anyway, the article is up on, it will be up on our website shortly. And it's in the latest issue of Nature. Now, as I said before, I'm trying to restructure this class where I only talk about one scientific discovery. I'll give one little report of what's been happening on the Reasons to Believe mission field, then we get into our text. And if you're new to the class, we're working through the 20 biblical creation accounts. So I'll give you a quick report on what happened in Dallas. I was there for 6 days and 5 nights. And it began with my giving a talk at Dallas Theological Seminary. We were there for a conference, but we got there a day early. And it was a great talk to the faculty and the students there at Dallas Theological Seminary. And I can tell you this, they strongly support the Ministry of Reasons to Believe, particularly the faculty. We have great support there. That night, we spoke at the University of Texas at Dallas. And that also was very well received. And probably a third of the people that came were international students, and that was really encouraging. Just a lot of Africans, almost every African nation was represented, and a lot of Eastern Europeans, a lot of Russians and Ukrainians and people from the former East European republics were there, and quite receptive. So that was a great experience. We also got to speak during the week at a church. And the place was packed to the gills. They were expecting maybe 100 people. We wound up getting 600-plus people to the event. It was a very exciting evening. Fuzz spoke. I spoke. I spoke on the origin of the universe. He spoke on the origin of life. A lot of enthusiasm for our biblical, testable creation model. As far as the conference goes, it was really historic in the sense that one of our supporters, Ide Trotter, some of you know him, he was on a Reasons to Believe function with several of us here in the class. He's had this burden ever since I brought out my book, Creation and Time, in 1994. And if you've read the book, I kind of end the book with an appeal that it's really time for the Christian community to have another Jerusalem Council. The Jerusalem Council, Acts 15, took on the circumcision debate and said, let's see what we can do to get this resolved. And likewise, I closed off that book by saying, we really need to settle this old earth, young earth controversy, and why don't we do what the first century church did, let's hold a council. And it's been Ide Trotter's passion to make that council happen. And frankly, I was naive. I thought this council shouldn't be a big deal. After all, International Council of Biblical Inerrancy took a stab at it with a few theologians. I found out that in Dallas there were several people who participated in that. That was an extremely contentious meeting. And really what's happened since 94 is the young earth creationists really don't want to go to such a meeting. But we set it up in such a way where we basically gave them all the cards. And, you know, they got to do a lot of speaking. We got to do a lot of listening. And we got to talk. But they were there. We had 30 people there, roughly half of them old earth creationists and half of them young earth creationists. And these were significant leaders in the movement. And also Ide was wise in that he took the advice of several, including us, to invite people who are not belligerent on this issue. So we made it a point to not invite those people who have been most belligerent in this debate, but to invite people that are more conciliatory. And in that sense, I would say the conference was a success. Nothing was really accomplished in terms of resolution, but there were some tiny steps in the direction of reconciliation. There was an agreement that this was a positive thing and we need to do it again, and nobody lost their cool. So in that sense, it was really good. And I can't give you any details, because, you know, in order to make this thing successful, it really does need to be a closed-door session. And so you won't see anything about it in our newsletters, and hopefully the other people there won't put it in their newsletters. So, but it was a good, positive first step. I got to speak at the one other church, Irvine Bible Church. It's a mega church. In fact, Fuzz was saying, boy, you know, we could easily get lost in this place. I mean, we went from one hall down one tunnel down to another, and it's one of those 20,000 member churches where everybody gets to know one another really well. So, yep. Well, they did have lots of small groups, but we had three meetings there, and the last day we were there, that was this past Sunday. And, you know, one of them, it was really interesting, this, we had an event for our apologists, because we're starting up at Dallas Chapter, so we invited people who've been through our training program. But one guy that showed up was one of Dallas's most outspoken atheist skeptics. And we said, you know, what's he doing here? I mean, this is a meeting where we're talking about organizing a chapter and doing Christian apologetics. But he talked very soon into my message, and as soon as I was finished, he was the first to ask a question. He said, you're probably all wondering why I'm here. And everybody said, yeah, we're all wondering why. He says, I'm here because Reasons to Believe gets attacked by intelligent design theorists and by young earth creationists, and you know I've been writing lots of articles about what I think about them, but because you guys are being attacked at them, I'm here. And I'm here to find out why you're being attacked by them. So it turned out that he, you know, it was a two-hour meeting, and he was very positively impressed with what we were doing there and the approaches we're taking. And I think what particularly impressed him was the fact that we kept saying, if we Christians are going to have any impact on secular society, we have to present a biblical, testable creation model that is successful in making predictions. And he says, I've been talking about that in my articles for years. And finally, someone seems to be listening to this. So, had some real pleasant times with them, and people in our chapter are following up. So, that was really good. And I got to tell you one other little story. It happened to me just before I walked into class. A couple came up to me and said, our son has just returned from Iraq. He's been there for like 14 months. And he says, but I got to tell you something about our son. He's been having a terrific ministry all over Iraq, handing out your Reasons to Believe books. So, and maybe that explains why our website gets so many hits from the Persian Gulf area. I think it's military people and the ministry they're doing. Okay, let's get into Job chapter 37. And again, for those of you that are new here, what we've been doing is going from Job 36:22 down to the end of chapter 37. And these are the final words of Elihu. I mean, the whole book of Job is basically a debate between Job and his three friends. But there's one young man who's been silent throughout the whole debate. And after the debate is over, he basically says, I've had enough. I gotta talk. He says, I'm younger than you. I'm not as wise as the rest of you, is what he says. He's being quite modest. He's clearly the wisest of the lot. But he has his words. And so these are the final words of Elihu. And as soon as Elihu stops speaking, God jumps in and starts talking. So Job 38 begins with God's little comments about this debate. But Elihu's final words, interestingly, focus on water. And of course, water's in the news with all the discoveries taking place on Mars. But it is interesting that Job closes off his little sermon all about water. And I'm going to read to you once again this chapter and a half all at once. I don't think I've ever read through it right to the end, so I'm going to do that for you. And I just want you to notice that this is one consistent message that Elihu is making about water. And he's actually putting the context. If you want to know how great God is, if you want to understand his character, his plan of righteousness for humanity, all you need to look at is water. That's all it takes. Okay, verse 22. God is exalted in his power. Who is a teacher like him? Who has prescribed his ways for him, or said to him, you have done wrong? Remember to extol his work, which men have praised in song. All mankind has seen it. Men gaze on it from afar. Nobody is left out. How great is God beyond our understanding? The number of his years is past finding out. Now I could stop there and say, he's making a statement about God and how nature reveals God to everybody. And it's incredible how great he is, now beyond our understanding he is. And he says, now I'm going to prove it to you. So here he gives us proof. And in his proof, he's just looking at water. Now he's looked at other things in the previous chapters. He says, I'm just going to focus on water and give you proof that everything I said about God must be true. Verse 27, he draws up the drops of water, which distill as rain to the streams. The clouds pour down their moisture, and abundant showers fall on mankind. Who can understand how he spreads out the clouds, how he thunders from his pavilion? See how he scatters his lightning about him, bathing the depths of the sea. This is the way he governs the nations and provides food in abundance. He fills his hands with lightning and commands it to strike its mark. His thunder announces the coming storm. Even the cattle make known its approach. At this my heart pounds and leaps from its place. Listen, listen to the roar of his voice, to the rumbling that comes from his mouth. He unleashes his lightning beneath the whole heaven and sends it to the ends of the earth. After that comes the sound of his roar. He thunders with his majestic voice. When his voice resounds, he holds nothing back. God's voice thunders in marvelous ways. He does great things beyond our understanding. He says to the snow, fall on the earth, and to the rain shower, be a mighty downpour, so that all men he has made may know his work. He stops every man from his labor. The animals take cover. They remain in their dens. The tempest comes out from its chamber, the cold from the driving winds. The breath of God produces ice, and the broad waters become frozen. He loads the clouds with moisture. He scatters his lightning through them. At his direction, they swirl around over the face of the whole earth to do whatever he commands them. He brings the clouds to punish men or to water his earth and show his love. Listen to this, Job. Stop and consider God's wonders. Do you know how God controls the clouds and makes his lightning flash? Do you know how the clouds hang poised, those wonders of him who is perfect in judgment? You who swelter in your clothes when the land lies hushed under the south wind, can you join him in spreading out the skies, hard as a mirror of cast bronze? Tell us what we should say to him. We cannot drop our case because of our darkness. Should he be told that I want to speak? Would any man ask to be swallowed up? Now, no one can look at the sun, bright as it is in the skies, after the wind has swept them clean. Out of the north he comes in golden splendor. God comes in awesome majesty. The Almighty is beyond our reach and exalted in power. In his justice and great righteousness he does not oppress. Therefore men revere him, for he does not have regard for all the wise in heart. Now, as I mentioned last time we were together, what I wanted to focus on this week was Job 37, verse 5 through 8. Now, verses 1 through 4 of Job 37 basically focus on lightning. And, you know, last time we were together, I mentioned the fact that this is really amazing in the context of the timing of the recording of this. This probably goes back 3,500 years in terms of the words that are written down here. And yet we have Elihu making all these statements about lightning. And it wasn't until starting about 200 years ago that scientists began to recognize how exquisitely fine-tuned lightning must be to sustain advanced life on planet Earth. How lightning bolts cracking in the sky the way the atmosphere is designed leads to significant nitrogen fixation, which supports the advanced green plants, which supports advanced life. But, you know, Job and his three friends and Elihu would have no context at that time of appreciating that. Yet he writes all this stuff about lightning, you know, how God blesses human beings with lightning, giving us just the right amount, just the right places, just the right time. But also makes the point here that there's something dangerous about the thunder and the lightning. I mean, we have a man in our church who was struck by lightning. He was fortunate enough to survive it, Bob Volchek. But he still has a scar down his neck to this very day from that lightning bolt. And, you know, if it's any encouragement to you, the probability of you getting struck by lightning in the state of California, which, by the way, California is a rather low lightning bolt strike rate compared to states like Texas and Oklahoma, but your probability of being struck by lightning is 6 times higher than your probability of winning the California lottery. Okay? So there is something dangerous about this lightning. But what it tells us is that, you know, God sends us advance warning that danger will soon be at hand. You know, his thunder talks about the thunder. And we mentioned last time that, you know, God has designed the atmosphere in such a way that when a thunderstorm is about to dump a pile of rain upon you, or hail, and sometimes these hailstones can be dangerous in themselves, not just the lightning bolts, he gives us advance warning. God has designed the weather systems and the atmosphere in such a way that if you're going to get really pummeled by one of these thunderstorms, you will know about it at least 30 minutes in advance. I mean, you're going to hear the advance of the storm and say, hey, it's coming my way. The thunderclaps are getting louder and louder. And that's your signal that it's time to take cover. And it makes the point here in the text that even the animals figure this out. You know, they hear the distant rumbling and the animals begin to look for their dens. They take cover because they know that hailstones might be coming down, thunder or lightning bolts might be striking, there might be fires, so they take cover. But it also says this is a signal to the men and the women to likewise stop their work, put things away, and take cover because a storm is about to hit. And, you know, if you're out there in the field and you get struck by lightning, in one sense, you've got yourself to blame because God gave you a warning. You could have taken cover. In Bob Volchek's case, he was out walking and it wasn't easy for him to take cover. Hey, I've been in that spot myself. I was in the high Sierras where a lightning storm came upon us. And I didn't feel a bolt, but a friend of mine who was just 15 feet away, we just got as low on the snow as we possibly could. I was kind of out in the open. He decided to take cover behind a rock. By the way, that's a bad idea during a lightning storm at high altitude. Don't go near a tree. Don't go near a rock. And stay away from a slope. You really want to be in what feels like the most exposed location of all. And that's kind of what, you know, I'm a physicist, so I kind of figured it out. Okay. So I was out in this glacier, and, you know, it looked like a bad spot because I was, you know, great flat in the glacier, and there was nothing around it. That was the highest thing there. But you get down really low on the ice, and I was fine, although my eardrum was kind of blasted by the lightning bolt. But my friend who was by the rock, he actually felt the heat of the lightning going through the rock, and his whole body tingled. He was fine, but the bolt hit just a few feet from him, and it was a while before he could hear properly. But the whole point of this text is, God does give us a warning, and in most cases, you're able to find some way to take advantage of that warning. Because what it says, a mighty downpour will come, rain shower, downpour. And then in the next passage after verse 8 here, starts talking about the ice. And you can get a lot of ice coming down with certain thunderstorms, and that can be dangerous. My father was raised in Alberta. And he tells me that there were times in his childhood when he saw hailstones come down the size of grapefruits. Well, I mean, a car left out will be totaled in such a hailstorm. It will really be bashed up. And if you happen to be outside that time without a hard hat, you probably will be dead. But God gives us warning. And by the way, isn't it great that there aren't too many places on planet Earth where you get grapefruit-sized hailstones? Places in Texas, places in Alberta, but 99% of the places where people live, those things never happen. California, it's never happened. And I think you can count on it not happening in the future. We do get hail, but we get these little tiny stones that are nice to look at and allow us to have a snowball fight in the middle of April, right? So, that's fun. Okay, but there's another point here I want to focus on. It says, he says to the snow, fall on the earth, and to the rain shower, be a mighty downpour. And this is all in the context of a thunderstorm. So we're talking hail and rain, intense rain. So that all men he has made may know his work. So people realize, you know, this is God. This is all part of God providing what is just right for us. He stops every man from his labor. Now, interestingly, you know, I can share this much about that conference we had at Dallas Theological Seminary, that, you know, probably the point of greatest contention of all between the old earth creationists, the young earth creationists, is the young earth creationists felt that all, quote, natural evil had to be blamed on human sin. And what I mean by that is their belief is that before Adam and Eve sinned, bad things like, hailstorms, and tornadoes and hurricanes just didn't happen. And meanwhile, us older as creationists are saying, hey, they really did happen. They claim they did not happen. That as soon as man sinned, this is the consequence of man's sin. And all these bad things we need to be blaming on Adam. But I would argue that the context of Job 37 here is that there is no such thing as natural evil. Rather, this is evidence of God's optimal care and provision for human beings. You know, we need a few earthquakes in order to sustain advanced life on planet Earth. And isn't it wonderful that we have just the right amount and intensity of earthquakes? Not too many, not too few, just right. Everything is just right. We have a just right number of hurricanes, tornadoes, and hailstorms. And the whole point that Elihu is making here is, can't you see how God provides for you through things that you call disasters? These disasters are part of God's ideal provision. And who are you as a man to say, you know what, I think I could do it better than God has done it? Because you don't even understand all this. And, you know, God's going to jump in and make that point quite clear in Job 38. In fact, it's interesting, when Job 38 and 39 and 40, where God starts his comments, he basically asks questions. Says, okay, you five think you're really smart. Let me give you a creation test. And he gives them a quiz about creation. And God's whole point is, you should not criticize me if you don't even understand the natural phenomena. But that's going on today. People are criticizing God and his way of dealing with us without really understanding what we like to call natural evil, or what the insurance industry calls acts of God. Okay, you probably got these insurance policies. They'll protect you against certain acts of God, but other acts of God, they won't. And, you know, we look at this as, you know, this is God doing all these nasty things to us, forest fires, grass fires. But can you imagine a planet Earth where fires never happen, there are no wildfires? It'd be easy for God to do that. All he's got to do is drop the oxygen level in the atmosphere by another 3%, and we can significantly diminish the forest and grass fires. And we wouldn't have our mountains here burning up all the time. However, dropping the oxygen content that low would mean that you would have to get by on a much lower level of activity than you're used to now. You're basically condemned to live the rest of your life as a sloth. You know, you're just not going to do very much, because without the oxygen to breathe, it's really going to limit your level of activity. And you say, well, in that case, why doesn't God give me more oxygen? I'll take a few more fires. Okay? I don't mind having a few more fires burning up the hills if I can add more oxygen so I can be more active. Well, that's true. God could bless you with more oxygen, and make you more active, but your body will wear out a lot faster. Your organs will go to pot. And we know that because shortly after World War II, when they had these jet aircraft that were going to high altitude, what did they do back then? They gave the pilots pure oxygen to breathe when they were in their fighter aircraft. And I remember, I'm old enough to remember jet fighter pilots who had that experience. Very few of them lived past the age of 50. Most of them died in their 40s from that experience. And it wasn't that they were in their aircraft that long, but they got that pure oxygen, and it did have its effect on the organs. So in that sense, we need to look back and then say, you know what? I'm really glad that the oxygen content of our atmosphere is 21%. I'm really glad it's not 22%. I'm really glad it's not 20%. It's just right. And sure, we get a few fires. But you want to know something else? Those fires are critical. If you have, we had a planet without fires, there wouldn't be any charcoal being built into the soil, and charcoal in the soil plays a critical role in enhancing the quality of life for the plants, and if their quality of life is enhanced, our quality of life is enhanced. So you need a few fires. And, you know, the redwoods can't survive without fires. It takes fires for them to reproduce, and it takes fires to get out all the underbrush that would normally choke out the growth of things like redwoods. So, you know, understanding all this, people are now saying, you know, it's good that we have a few wildfires, and therefore the policy of our national park system now is when a natural wildfire happens, they just let it burn out. They don't try to put it out. Unless it's going to threaten a city or a village, then they take some action. And I can tell you, these hills here need regular burning in order to sustain the ecology of those hills, given the rainfall that they have. So I won't go into this in any more detail, but the point I really want to drive out here is that there's another benefit from these so-called disasters. And we shouldn't call them disasters. It's part of God's optimal design. In fact, I would challenge you, take any act of God, and I'll show you the optimal design in that act of God, whatever it might be. And hey, if you want to pick one, we can take it on. A lot of this is up on our website. But another point here is that these storms that take place also play a role in forcing us to take some rest. Because he stops every man from his labor. And we need a few stoppages of labor. And Phaedra tells us why we need these stoppages of labor. It's in the phrase just before. So all men he has made may know his work. Whose work? God's work. He stops every man from his labor. There's a lot of people out there that really don't take time to meditate on who God is, how powerful he is, and how well he has provided for us through all these things. But you know, a really good thunderstorm where the hail is pounding down, you can't go outside and do the things you want to do. You really have to stop your work. You're forced to stop your work. It gives you a few hours to say, wow. And some people do that. Well, look at little children. You get a really big lightning storm with lots of hail coming down. What do? They all crowd around the window to watch. And I think that's the point here. We crowd around the window to watch and say, look at how great God is. You know, isn't this just really incredible? Isn't this exciting to watch? Then you begin to say, you know, again, little children are good. They'll go to their parents and say, how come? Why does this happen? And there's your opportunity to share it with your children. And this old point here, he stops every man, so we may be able to consider God's work, why he does things the way he does, and how marvelous his design is. Well, God has many ways of forcing us to take some time off and to rest. Got a comment back there? Yeah. Right. I think it's very difficult to read the Bible without drawing the conclusion that the Garden of Eden was a relatively small geographical location on the surface of planet Earth that did not describe the conditions of the whole planet. Now, what is the point of speculation amongst Bible scholars is that if Adam and Eve had not sinned, and you know, they had obeyed God's command to multiply and fill the earth, and you've heard me talk about this before, if Adam and Eve had just simply let things go their own way without sin, there would have been 6 billion people on the face of the earth in just 750 years. So, this is going to stress the Garden of Eden. But there are those who have suggested what the Bible would have implied if Adam and Eve had not sinned and their descendants had not sinned, is that they would work to extend the conditions of the Garden of Eden under God's instruction and direction, so they would get bigger and bigger as the human population got bigger and bigger. All this is speculative because Adam and Eve evidently sinned in relatively short order, and then God kicked them out of the Garden of Eden. Some reasons why we know this interpretation, I think, must be correct is that in the early chapters of Genesis, it talks about the land of Nod as being east of Eden. And in other places, it talks about Eden as a location. So in that sense, I don't think it can be the whole planet. And the thorns and the thistles were not in Eden. But I believe there are thorns and thistles outside of Eden, even before Adam and Eve sinned. Now the context is God planted this garden. He created this garden, and the garden was a protected place. And you know, in a well-kept garden, you're not going to have weeds. And so there won't be thorns and thistles there. You won't have pests there. But as soon as Adam and Eve got ejected, basically God says, this is the real world. This is the world it was before I planted this beautiful garden and protected it for you. And now you got to make your own garden. And it's got to be weeded. And you're going to have to work a little harder than you did in your Eden. Adam was working in the Garden of Eden. But once he got ejected from Eden, he was working harder. Now you say, isn't this unfair? Shouldn't have God told him all this in advance? I believe Adam already knew. You know, a little subtle phrase, it's in Genesis chapter 2. It says that when God created Adam, he then placed him in Eden, which means that Adam was created outside of Eden. So he saw the thorns and the thistles. He saw the death that was out there. And then he was placed inside the Eden. So when God told him that in the day that you eat of that fruit, referring to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall surely die, he knew what death was all about because he had seen it already. By the way, this came up at the conference. We had a session on, you know, was there death before Adam? I think that's a critical passage in Genesis chapter 2, that namely that Adam was placed in Eden, and God talked to him about death without explaining it to him. I mean, that's right there in the text. So evidently, Adam did not need a lot of education from God about death because he was already a witness to it. So he knew what God was talking about. Yes? You're right. I was way too brief on this. I'm trying to look at the clock here. But you're right on, is that there was other reasons why God had them removed from Eden. That was to keep them from the tree of life, because if they got access to the tree of life, this would limit God's dealing with their sin. I mean, unlike the angels, God is able to take sinful human beings and redeem them to the state that they had before. Notice that option doesn't exist for the angels. So, no tree of life. But I also would argue that God removing Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden would ensure that they would receive pain, extra pain, commensurate to the sin they commit, and extra work commensurate with the sin that they commit. Whereas in the Garden of Eden, that discipline would have been obviated to a great degree. For example, if you really, in your selfishness and desire to save a lot of time for yourself, are really sloppy about the weeding, then the thistles and thorns will take over the place, and you've got a lot more work to do. Whereas if no thorns and thistles there in the first place, you know, that lesson may not come home to you, just to give that one example. And so outside the Garden of Eden was a better environment for God to deal with the evil within man, because the discipline was already built in. Whereas in the Garden of Eden, a lot of that discipline had been obviated. But you're absolutely right. Keeping away from that tree of life was critical in order to make sure that a pathway would be set up for by physical death, both of human beings and through the death of Christ on the cross, could bring about a redemption. Without that, well, eventually Eden was taken over. So it must have been a really good place because God was rather intent on keeping people out of there for a while. You know, now that enough decay is built in, there's no need. It's no better than anywhere else on planet Earth. But for a while, God was busy making sure that nobody had access to it. Yes. For creationists, always start with Scripture, then give the scientific evidence after that. A scriptural point that you could make would be Jeremiah 33:25. Jeremiah 33:25 refers to the the laws that govern the operation of the heavens and the earth, and refers to them as being fixed. I haven't got, maybe someone can actually read it there. But the fact that it refers to the fixity of these laws would indicate that from a biblical perspective, there was no fundamental change in the laws of physics when Adam and Eve sinned. I believe the appropriate interpretation of Genesis 3 is that Adam and Eve experienced a dramatic change. Not the physics, they did. But because they experienced a dramatic change, there were dramatic consequences upon the resources of planet Earth. Now we're going to be dealing with a lot more thistles and thorns than we otherwise would, because man is now a sinner. We're going to see a lot more harmful erosion of the agricultural land because man is a sinner. And we're going to see extinction of bird and mammal species because man is a sinner. And this is something we've all witnessed since that point. But the physics didn't change. A second scriptural point that we could mention is what you see in Genesis 1. Genesis 1, even before Adam and Eve are created, it talks about stars. It talks about the sun and refers to the sun and stars as being useful as guides to mark times and seasons and years for the advanced animals that God creates in the fifth and sixth creation day. That is a statement that stars and the sun are stable light beacons in the sky. Now, the significant thing about that is that the stability of stars is very critically dependent on the laws of physics not changing. If there's any change in those laws of physics, even very slight changes, then you're not going to get stable burning stars. You know, something that I learned when I took my first course in stellar structure as an undergraduate is that that's what the professors love to do. They take you through all these equations that describe stellar stability, and what you see is even the slightest tweak, you're going to wind up with stars never forming, period, or stars forming and immediately exploding. And you want to know how small a change it is? You change the physics by one part in 10,000 trillion, 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 you don't get stable burning stars. That doesn't leave a lot of room for the changes in the laws of physics. A third argument you could make is that the text tells us that there were plants and animals before Adam were created. That means there's metabolism going on. That means there's protein folding taking place and protein synthesis going on. That's another arena that's extremely sensitive to even the slightest changes in the laws of physics. Changing ever so slightly, that's not going to happen. Now, all that is in the context of before Adam and Eve were even created. So in that sense, I would argue from a biblical perspective, that doesn't leave the door open for systemic change in the laws of physics. I would argue that also applies to the flood. You know, that was a big part of the debate. Did the laws of physics change in the flood? Did the laws of physics change when Adam sinned? I would argue the Bible makes it quite clear that did not happen. Now, I'll give you one quick scientific one, then we've got to close off the class. We know it couldn't have happened for two easy scientific reasons. One is the anthropic principle. There are literally dozens of different factors in the constants of physics and the laws of physics that will tell you whether or not life is possible, and advanced life in particular. You know, something like the velocity of light, change it ever so slightly any time in cosmic history, there is no possibility for physical life at any time in cosmic history. So the very fact that we're here argues against the change in the laws of physics. And then another scientific argument I think works quite well. We can actually observe the laws of physics in the past. We can observe them directly. When you look at the sun, you're measuring the physics of the universe 8.25 minutes ago. And when we do that, the laws of physics are the same as they are right now. You can extend that to the Crab Nebula. That's 7,000 light years away. So now you're looking at the laws of physics 7,000 years ago. It's identical to what we measure in the present. And by that token, astronomers can pick objects at all varying distances throughout cosmic history. And what do we see? The laws of physics are exactly what we see right here. Now, to be fair, there is some debate that perhaps a couple of the constants of physics might have varied by one part in 100,000 over 12 billion years. But hey, that's a rather tiny change. It's so tiny that I think it could still be interpreted in the context of Jeremiah 33:25. That's fixed to 17 places of decimal. That's not bad. So in that sense, I think we don't have a case for a systemic change. And one that I think might work better, because when I gave that point at the conference, I don't think it was well understood by many of the participants there. And in hindsight, I realized I would have been probably better off referring to ice layers in Greenland and Antarctica, because there you've got a continuous layering of the ice layers. And we know that they pertain to the historical time record, because you can actually earmark volcanic eruptions. The Vesuvius eruption that wiped out the city of Pompeii, you can see recorded both in an Antarctic ice ring and in a Greenland ice ring. So it shows us that the dating of the annual rings is accurate, because it matches historical events. Now, in terms of how those ice layers would be layered down, if there was a change in the laws of physics, you're going to see it in the ice layers, because those ice layers trap things like air pockets. They trap radioactive particles, so you can check the radiometric decay rate. Now, it's not as good as saying everything's constant over the past 13 billion years like you get in astronomy, but hey, it gets you back at least 120,000 years. The Antarctic one actually gets you back more than a million years. So that's enough, I think, to settle the debate. So that assumes people aren't emotionally locked. And the problem is this you were talking about today, this idea of natural evil is a huge emotional loss. A loving God, a God that's all-loving and all-powerful, won't hurt us with earthquakes, tornadoes, forest fires, and earthquakes. He's not going to do that. And therefore, it must have something to do with Adam's sin, because a loving God wouldn't have done that without the context of sin. So that's why I think the passage we're studying is critical. By the way, not just for that. Lots of atheists ask the same question. I mean, that's kind of the big argument of atheists, to say is the Christian God can't exist, because if the Christian God existed, he wouldn't tolerate things like hailstones coming down the sides of grapefruits, lightning hitting people and killing them. He's not going to do that. But Elihu here says God does that, and we should be thankful that he does that. But you know what? It's really tough to say that to someone who's been struck by lightning. It's really tough to say that to someone whose home has been devastated by a wildfire. So we have to recognize that the emotional issues are there. Next time we get together, we're going to talk about how to deal with those emotional issues, okay? Because otherwise you come across as really glib and unfeeling, and it doesn't work. You come across as one of these hard-nosed scientists who thinks he knows it all. I mean, you know, it just doesn't go over. Okay, final word. Well, as someone that has actually read up on this, I don't think we're quite at the point where we can predict earthquakes. So I mentioned that one time in the class here. If we were to set up the right system in the LA Basin, we could give people a 6-second warning of an impending earthquake. So that's enough to... Yeah. 6 seconds is helpful. In fact, there's one study that says if we spend a little more money than that, we could even give people a 30-second warning. Ooh, yeah, 30 seconds. Yeah, go for it. Right. And, you know, we also have to acknowledge that human beings today have made these natural disasters worse. We've brought quite a bit of this on ourselves. We're making the tornadoes and the hurricanes worse than God had intended them to be. And we're living in places... Yeah, I mean... Well, the other thing, keep in mind the words of Jesus. The wise man builds his house upon a rock. The foolish man builds his house on the east coastal areas of South Florida. Okay? If you build your house there on the shore, you're going to get wiped out by a hurricane sooner or later. So where you choose to put that house is critical. And if you are going to put your house in California, you better obey the building code. Don't try to shortchange the building code. It will catch up with you. Okay. So bolt your house to the rock. All right. Father in heaven, we thank you for this time we've had in your word. Thank you, Lord, for blessing us with this creation debate that took place 3,500 years ago. And Lord, people today are still debating over creation, both believers and unbelievers. And I pray, Father, we could draw wisdom and insight and grace from these passages that will help us in our witness today. And Lord, in that process, may we see many come to know you as Lord and Savior. And Lord, may you build our character in the process and our pathway to sanctification. In Jesus' name, amen.